I spoke last weekend in Portland because they had their big activity, and Bob Dick had asked me, since I was going to be there for the weekend to speak on the Sabbath. A lot of the men that attend on a regular basis rotate that assignment between them. We don't go over generally for the weekend anymore, so he asked me to speak. I gave a sermon on a personal relationship with God. Now, I won't be giving that here because the honest answer is pieces and parts of that from various sermons have already been given here over years. Alan did put it on the archives if you want to go at least and listen to it in that way. But I spent a lot of time trying to find something that I could reach out to a younger audience, at least by focus, and to try to, you know, catch their attention and say something to them. So I spent a lot of time internalizing what I wanted to say, and what happened is, as a course, there were times when I just wasn't even looking at my notes, which means there's times when you wander off course of what you plan to say, and you get into sometimes dangerous territory as you begin to comment on things that you hadn't planned. But there was a part of my notes when I was done with the sermon I went back to, and I realized I had completely missed. I thought, well, maybe that was good, maybe that wasn't, but it's what it was. And I wanted to take that portion of my notes and come back then and develop it. It was something I've not addressed here locally, and bring it to you today. So my question is it boring to be a Christian? So the young person, again, I was trying to reach more directly a younger mix of an audience. But does a young person look at the fact that it's boring to really be in a committed relationship with God, to restrict your life in certain ways, to certain behaviors? You know, you can't have all the wild hair and all the wild dress and all the wild activities, not in that same way. So is that boring, or does that seem like it would be? Among some of the Amish community, there is a tradition that's called Rumspringa. It's not all the Amish, and it's applied in different ways amongst different groups, but the word means running around. And it kind of applies to the time for young people from about mid-teens to into their young adulthood. And again, it's used in different ways, and it's not everywhere, but it is in part within that community. Some use it as a time to date in preparation for marriage. And so there's an allowance for a social contact in a different way than there would have been. But for others, it's a time to experience the world before deciding to get baptized. They literally will come out of the community in various activities and try the world a little bit and see what it tastes like. And it's their assessment. There's a certain amount of tolerance, and again, portions of the Amish community for the practice. That doesn't mean they can go out and just shoot somebody. It's not quite on that scale. But, you know, it is tasting the world before you make your commitment. It's an interesting concept. I wonder if some of the young people in the Church of God kind of feel a little bit the same way. First, you got to get your friends, and you got to get your education, and you have to get a job, and you have to get some things. We all need things. You need to have a few things. And then you have to have some fun. And then you can really seriously consider, now, am I ready to make my commitment? It said in the Amish community, in the articles that I read, that most of those actually do. The draw of the community is so strong, and the culture is so infused in those who are in it, that most of us do actually keep that commitment or make it when the time comes. Being in a fully committed relationship to God, does that sound boring when you're looking forward to it as a younger person in this life? When Megan and Derek were growing up, I always say when I grew up, to the degree I did, we all kind of go through that, don't we? We grow up to the degree we do. But when they were in our house growing up and the word boring would get used, we'd just give them something else to do. You're bored. All right. Well, let's go vacuum the front room. You're bored. Well, I tell you what, we need to dust some of the bedrooms. So after a while, it became rather, you know, dangerous for them to even use the term bored. They were kind of careful. And sometimes they'd kick themselves, and they'd stop. Now, the way it works out in church, when you get bored in church and the sermon starts droning on, you got to go to the bathroom. You know, no parent wants their child to not be able to go to the bathroom, and the children know that. So then when they get fidgety a little bit and it's been long enough and the sermon is not quite finished, it's off. And nature calls, you know, we got to get up and go to the bathroom. So we had to fight that as our kids grew up because they wanted to use the bathroom breaks to break up the sermon and services. And, you know, it's kind of a fight, so we just figured, all right, here's what we'll do. We'll just charge you $1 every time you go. You can go as many times as you want, please. Buy us dinner, all right? You know, go ahead, 5 times, buck a time. And it's amazing how that changed their behavior because they had a little bit of money and they had to make that stretch and they wanted to use it well. The first one that had to pay was Michelle. First one. As soon as we set that rule, I took the dollar out, handed, you know, I got to go. Well, but anyway, that solved the problem with Megan and Derek. Is being a Christian boring? Does it appear like that compared to the world? Tom Hanks had the movie Forrest Gump. Can't say Gump any other way. There was a phrase or a statement in that movie, stupid is as stupid does. Of course, mother told him that. So I'd like to kind of borrow that a little bit, and I would say boring is as boring does. Your life is boring. Is that really a product of circumstance, or is that an attitude and approach? I'm not saying there are things in this life that are tedious and repetitive and difficult, but that's not the point. If your life is boring, if your life as a Christian is boring, or if it looks like it will be someday, then you know that isn't necessarily environmental. I do believe a lot of that is simply attitude and approach. In the book of Ecclesiastes, chapter 3, verse number 9, God tells us that this life is full of labor. You're going to work. And when you're done working, you'll work some more, and maybe a little more after that. You will labor in this life. Because what profit has the worker from that in which he labors? I've seen the God-given task. God gave us a life in which to labor. I've seen the God-given task with which the sons of men are to be occupied. He's made everything beautiful in its time. He's put eternity into their hearts. Why is God comparing the labor of this life to eternity? Because if you think it's boring to live 70 years, if that's what your mentality or mind is, then what's it going to be like to live forever? How many times will you run out of something then to do? You know, in eternity, the front room won't even need to be vacuumed. But God says he's put eternity into their hearts, and he's comparing that to the labor of this flesh, what we do in the time we have here compared to maybe what we're going to be doing forever, except that no one can find out the work that God does from the beginning to end. You can't quite understand what it is that God does to stay busy, that God is happy and pleased and doing quite well. He says, I know that there's nothing better for them than to rejoice and to do good in their lives. In this life, we are to rejoice always, we are to be thankful always, we are to labor and be busy and be productive and fruitful. We are not to be bored. That is an attitude and approach. And also that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labor, it is the gift of God. So God gives us a means whereby we have a reward. And it says, if God does it, it will work, it will stay, it will produce. Whatever God does, it shall be forever. Nothing can be added to it, nothing taken from it. God does it that men should fear before him. So God shows us that there is indeed a way, an approach, a manner in which we should live this life to be fruitful. Proverbs 28 gives a reference to those who would like to kind of short circuit and cut the corner a little bit to get where they want to go. I gave the example in my sermon in Portland. Many of you will think of it in your own ways. First house didn't have a dishwasher, didn't have a garage door opener, didn't have much of anything, actually. Very small. If you plugged anything in, you had to unplug something else. It was built, I think, in the 1920s. So the electrical system and all of the appliance setups and the layout was from that day. But, you know, over time, you got rid of the cement blocks that were part of your bookcases, and you actually got a real bookcase. And you actually got some furniture that you didn't get for free or handed down or at the thrift store. And at some point in time, you actually began to decorate so the things would match. But that took decades. It took decades to get something where the oven was actually self-cleaning at the same time the garage was self-opening and the same time the dishwasher worked. But we live in a society where everybody says, well, you want that now. You know, you walk in the door and start out with everything that's supposed to be in place and work. You just skip the cinder blocks and go right to Tiffany's. And life just doesn't necessarily work that way. So Proverbs 28 is a warning, verse number 20. It says, a faithful man will abound with blessings, but he who hastens to be rich will not go unpunished. Well, hastening to be rich is part of our culture today. And God says, you'll be punished. Because what you'll do is you'll try to get there too quick. You'll try to get there without having labored for it. You will not have sacrificed. You might have simply indebted yourself. And you've put yourself at risk. To show partiality is not good. Because for a piece of bread, a man will transgress. But a man with an evil eye hastens after riches. Doesn't consider that poverty will come upon him. So God wanted us to labor. And he wanted that labor to be intense. And he wanted it to be extensive. He did. He didn't mean for us to live a life of leisure. The world was not created in that way. Things grow, they have to be planted. They have to be cared for and tended. They have to be harvested. And then they have to be planted again. I Googled, you could have picked any phrase you like, but I Googled lottery winners who go broke. You could have picked your phrase. And it put up the first page. And I didn't want to give a lot of personal examples of these things because I don't know that that's necessary. But I will read you just a few of the headings that came up immediately. How one lottery winner blew through $10 million in less than 10 years. Just gone. What could happen to you? Tales of big lottery winners. Will the winner of the next Powerball drawing be one of the luckiest people on earth? Actually, no. You will be punished. You will be punished. Others go overboard. Some lottery winners wind up dead. I mean, literally, because of the money and the relationships, and how those circumstances play out, literally, some of them end up being killed. If you're not disciplined, you will go broke. There was one story I read of a millionaire who won the lottery who went broke. Now, he wasn't broke until he won the lottery, because he earned the million, and he kept and used the million, or whatever amount that was. But you see, the lottery changed the whole dynamic in the course, and he ended up losing the winnings and his million, and he went broke. Lottery winners who blew it all. 8 lottery winners who lost their millions. Why lottery winners go bankrupt. And then a few more articles on that line. It's better to work for something. It's better to labor than to receive an inheritance. Now, we all want an inheritance. Fine, please. Just give it to me and watch me do well. But when you don't work for something, you do not treasure it. If you haven't labored and sacrificed, it will probably go to waste. But it'll not only go to waste, it'll take what you did labor for, and it'll go away as well. It's actually a risk and a danger. Proverbs 9, where do you think that comes from? That risk and danger, and that desire to hit it big, to make it big, to not have to labor, to kind of just want to walk in the door and have what you want right at the beginning. Proverbs 9, verse 13, comes from Satan. It's not God's way. We live in a culture that promotes the fact that you ought to receive something and get your due, as compared to you ought to be a man up and get the job done, as was referenced in the sermonette. A foolish woman is clamorous. She's simple and knows nothing. She sits at the door of her house on a seat by the highest places of the city to call to those who pass by, who go straight on their way. Whoever is simple, let him turn in here. Here's the message, though. As for him who lacks understanding, she says to him, stolen water is sweet. Bread eaten in secret is pleasant. But he does not know that the dead are there and that her guests are in the depths of the grave or hell, as it says. You know, stolen water is sweet. Well, it is in some ways. When you do something and you get away with it, I mean, the adrenaline is running or it's enticing and there's a certain amount of fear and excitement that is not replicated always in some other way. You know, when you're hoeing down the row over time, you don't have that same adrenaline rush. And so it actually imprints into your mind that's the way it needs to be. That's what's so enticing about sin sometimes is that rush and that risk and that pressure. But boy, that imprints on the brain, kind of like winning the lottery. But it changes all the rules. And as it says here, you don't know that the dead are there. Her guests are in the grave. It can be very, very destructive. What did I want in this life? Well, in the most basic sense, I wanted adventure. I did. That's what I wanted. That's where I was headed. Took flying lessons. Took scuba lessons. Parachuted. Rock climbed. Skied, sailed on the ocean, took lessons, and each of those things I actually took lessons to where I could either, if need be, certify or be in a position where someday maybe I could turn and then try to teach others, because I wanted to have an adventure sports resort, and I wanted to have it set up where people would come to the resort and they'd stay there, and then we would take them on various adventures and activities, and that to me was just the finest life that I could even possibly imagine. And so we did, and we collected up gear as we went on. I had a friend that was looking at doing the same thing with us, and that was my plan. Eventually, not too long, frankly, out of school, God called me into the ministry. And the ministry doesn't do all those things, generally speaking. In the church, what do? Well, we play basketball and volleyball, and back then we ran track. Remember the big hole in the ground in Pasco? The big track meet area we would have down there. We used to come up there from Boise at the time and go to big regional track meets. But in the church, we had basketball, volleyball, and track. And I was thinking rock climbing and parachuting and scuba diving and all those amazing and wonderful things. And so in my mind, I always, every year, I was absolutely dedicated, and Michelle was too. We gave our life into the church and the ministry and trying to serve and do the best we could. So we had a great time. I had a lot of great volleyball games. Wasn't too good at basketball. That was a weakness, but pretty good track for, you know, that's still limber back then and fairly fast. And so we had some great things we were able to do, enjoyed it. But every year in my mind, I would say, well, there's always next year. Always next year. And I'd run and I'd work out so I'd stay in shape so that when the time came, hoping that it would, let the adventure begin. Well, United Church of God started in 1995. Challenger Camp opened up in 1996. I became staff at Challenger Camp in 1997. and I climbed the Grand Teton in 1998 for the first time. I thought that was pretty amazing. I was 47 years old when the door opened. I waited through my life for let the adventure begin, and at 47 that door opened. It didn't open right out of college. It wasn't there immediately. It was actually deferred a very long time by my perspective. But I worked out, stayed in shape, did push-ups and ran and worked out on the rock, handholds and things to try to be ready. And you know what? That door opened. God's merciful in various ways, but it isn't where God even wants us always to have it right away. That is simply not in our best interest. You work for it. You labor for it. You sacrifice. You endure. And then when it comes, you appreciate it. You will treasure it. You will use it well. Psalm 37 references at least what God's desire is in working with us. But you see, we want Him to fulfill our desire today. That's not always in our interest. Psalm 37, verse number 1. Do not fret because of evildoers, nor be envious of the workers of iniquity, for they shall soon be cut down like the grass and wither as the green herb. Herb. They said herb probably when they made this book. Trust in the Lord and do good. Dwell in the land. Feed on His faithfulness. Delight yourself also in the Lord. Put God first. Do what He gives us to do. Do it well. Rejoice. Don't walk around, you know, with your moan and groan visible to everyone, but says, and He shall give you the desires of your heart. Well, it's not a guarantee that if you like red sports cars, you'll get one, but the honest answer is, you just might. The desires of your heart are the things that you will focus on, and you will reach for, and in various ways, God often will enable us to at least have an opportunity to attain. In my case, He waited till I was, 47, and He opened that door for me, and it was open for a pretty good stretch of years. Most of the climbs that we did over those years were two-day climbs. You would haul all your gear up to a base camp, set up your tent and gear and eat and place you could kind of rest and get ready, and then head out early in the morning. You'd finish the climb. You'd break down to the lightest amount of gear that you needed for the rest of it. Most of those climbs were rock climbs and or ice, snow, alpine type climbs. And then you'd come all the way back down, break down the tent, off over the gear, put back, and go all the way back out that day. So they were two-day activities. Two-day activities. That left 363 days a year to get ready. Now, you climb once a year, and I tried to climb once a year. Some years were a little better, other years were not quite, but that's basically what I was trying to do. I wanted the resume. If I'm going to teach at the program, at the camp, that I had to say, well, I'm in the business at some level. This isn't something I heard about or I saw somebody do. This is something I'm invested in myself as a teacher. So we did. We basically tried. I tried to at least have a climb that I did during the year at some point. It took 2 days to make the climb. I had 363 days to get ready for the next one. 363 is a lot of tedium compared to two. And the thrill and the excitement of the 2 days, which was high octane, for me it was, and the 2 days are the pictures that I have in my office now on the wall. I don't have pictures of the 363 days because, you know what? It wasn't the same. That was the grunt work. It was the mileage. It was the anaerobic training. It was running the hills. It was the push-ups. It was all of those other things that, in one way you could say, man, that's boring. But then you'd have to pay a dollar if you were at church, and maybe you'd have to go do some chores if you were at home. But the fact is, life is about labor. Let's just get it straight. It's about working and producing and accomplishing in a productive way. 1 Corinthians 9, it's really not about the 2 days, it's about the 363. That's just the way it is. 1 Corinthians 9, 25. Everyone who competes for the prize is temperate in all things. You know what? You can't just go do whatever you want because you have to be ready to do what it is you really want. So you have to moderate some of the other choices. Now they do it to obtain a perishable crown. We for an imperishable crown. Paul's drawing the analogy of Christianity. Christianity is about the labor. It is about the day in, the day out, doing the right thing, doing it again, helping someone else do the right thing, helping them do it again. That's what Christianity is about. And it's about rejoicing as you go. I run thus, not with uncertainty, thus I fight, not as one who beats the air. I discipline my body and I bring it into subjection, lest when I preach to others, I myself should be disqualified. Life is about getting ready. It is about the training. The kingdom is what comes at the end. And so it's about labor. Is it boring to be a Christian? Well, I hope not. Because it's not an environmental problem that's the problem. It's the mentality that needs to be addressed. As Alan and I always do, some point on Friday night, we have to post what the title is for the cybercast, and then he uses that for the archives if I don't change. So we're talking last night, and I told him my title, and you know, sometimes we word it a little differently, go back and forth, and then in the course of our conversation, he said the strangest thing. I thought it was. Alan and I used to go skiing years ago when he was a kid compared to now. But we used to go skiing and he had an old Toyota. And they had Toyota ski free days, so you'd get one free and you paid one. Bill was back in those days, times when we were doing that. And so Alan would drive because he had the Toyota, and we'd get in 2 for 1 and split the cost, and then we'd ski all day, and we back then used to go up to Schweitzer. And we really did have a good time. But he said last night, he says, you know, one of the days when we were up there and we were riding one of the lifts together, he said, what I said was that what I really wanted was to go to Africa. And I thought, I don't even remember the conversation. He said, no, you did. He said, I really want to go to Africa. And you started talking about Stanley and Livingston, and you've read his stories, and that's what you really just wanted to get a chance to do that as well. You know, that's an amazing thing. That was before the door opened for me to go. And Alan is reminding me that that was one of the things I really wanted. Well, I got to go to Africa at 53. That's not exactly when you're a spring chicken. That's not early on in your days. 53 was when that door opened. I was supposed to go with Fred Kellers because he had been over there working before and knew the ropes enough to where he could bring me in and begin to, you know, let me develop and show me the way. And we were supposed to meet in Amsterdam, and Mike White was late, so he went on. I came into Amsterdam and had to go on into Nigeria by myself. Made me a little bit nervous because I didn't know the rules. And back then, it was a little different place than it is today. He got into Nigeria, and I wasn't caught up with him, so he went on again. And I came in, and I didn't know anybody, and I'm in the airport. Dari comes, and well, I didn't even know it was Dari back then. I forget when we first went in the very first time. But anyway, they picked me up at the airport, and we kind of got settled, but I was by myself. And so now I'm traveling across country with some of the church brethren, catching up with Fred, trying to. And finally in O'Leary, I caught him at the hotel. And he came out, and I actually walked up to him, and I said, well, Dr. Livingston, I presume. I felt like, you know, I'm living the dream. I'm here I am. I'm in this, you know, the dark continent, and I'm chasing down Fred Keller. So I finally found him. Again, I was 53. That didn't come early in life. It didn't come right away. It didn't come when you had your height of health and strength and vigor. But you know what God did? He blessed me and gave me health and strength and vigor at a level that, quite frankly, wouldn't necessarily have been normal in that stage. Look at Matthew 7. Shel and I have talked about this, gone back and forth over this scripture, verse number 7. God is our Father. It says, ask, it will be given to you. Seek, and you'll find. Knock, and it will be opened to you. Everyone who asks, receives. He who seeks, finds. To him who knocks, it will be opened. What man is there among you who his son asks for bread will give him a stone? If he asks for a fish, will give him a serpent? If you then, being evil, know how to give good gifts to your children, how much more will your Father who is in heaven give good things to those who ask him? It says, therefore, whatever you want men to do to you, do also to them. If that's a good thing, then do a good thing. Help them along their way. It says, this is the law and the prophets. So we read this, we make our little list out, say, I'm going to ask, and now, God, you're going to deliver. What if what a good thing is that we need is patience? What if the good thing that we need is endurance? What if giving us the lottery is going to destroy our character and ruin what resources we already have? What if that? Do we still want God to do it anyway and give us the chance and then we'll just decide that for ourselves? God is a Father who has perfect understanding of our needs. And so sometimes we fill in the blanks on this the way we want the list made up, but God might be responding the way that he knows is best. At some point, you have to trust that God knows what is good. That's what faith is. We believe that he is. We believe that he's good. That he's a rewarder of those who diligently seek him. And that's where you stand. When God makes his choice, and when he responds to us, or when he tells us to wait, you stand on the fact that God is perfectly good. And you go no further. So, going back, boring is, as boring does. Is being bored a circumstance? Or is being bored an attitude? Well, think about it. On our way to Portland, there was a baptism performed. I don't know if it was announced. James Dakota was baptized. We went on to Portland, so I don't know if that was announced down there or not. I'm assuming it was, but anyway, I'll just mention it as I go through. But he got baptized at a friend's house, and a friend and his wife had their family. They had a couple of children. And so afterwards, we're sitting at the table, and the son was studying engineering and working on various projects and trying to get set up in an internship, and the daughter was going to school and taking piano lessons, and actually as a sport she was doing fencing, and so we were having a delightful discussion with these two young people, and their lives were filled with various endeavors and experiences and desires, and because their lives were filled with things, you could have a conversation and ask them about their life and they had something to say. What they didn't say was, well, actually, I'm just bored. Bored. I don't do anything. And it's not my fault. It's everybody else's fault. It's my life's fault. It's my circumstance. I'm sure glad they didn't say that. I go into the bank, make a deposit, and they say, how's it going? You know what? If you say, it's going great. They will literally look at you and say, thank you. They'll say, thank you many times for actually saying that things are good. They're saying, oh, I don't know, it could be better, you know, or whatever, you know. Well, I'm alive, you know. You know, made it into the bank one more time, you know, crawled in the door. We had a wonderful conversation there just talking to these young people that just had some things they wanted to try to do, and they had hopes and dreams, but they were doing things along the way. It wasn't just a bunch of stuff, someday I hope. No, they had things they were wanting to accomplish. What did you learn last week? What did you learn last week? What is new about your perspective? What are you studying to understand to learn next week? Or is the life just on hold? Not what has circumstance forced on us, but what are we striving ourselves to do? Jesus said, my Father works and I work. They're busy. You wouldn't want to live for eternity if you weren't busy. If there wasn't productive activity, if there wasn't creative thought, you wouldn't want to do it. It would be a burden. And you know what? God wouldn't want you to do it either. Because all you do is frustrate everybody else. You know, Eeyore. You know, life's not good. Well, life's tough. There are tough moments. There are hard things. There are tears. Sometimes tears last for a while. But the sun does come up in the morning, and we do need to look at things in the best possible way. Job 34 reminds us that those choices we make, those things that we do, are recognized and responded to by God. Job 34, verse 10. Elihu speaking, and I did give a sermon on Job fairly recently, but in verse 10 it says, listen to me, you men of understanding. Far be it from God to do wickedness. See, God is good. You got to know that. And from the Almighty to commit iniquity. For he repays man according to his work, and he makes man to find the reward according to his way. He repays every man according to his work. If you do evil work, then, you know, the payment is not very pleasant. If you do good work, the reward and the benefits and the blessings will follow. One of the books I just basically finished reading, Touch the Top of the World by Eric Weidenmayer. I'm not perfectly sure I pronounced his last name. The spelling is a little difficult for me, but he's blind, and this is one of the first, this is his first book, I think. After he wrote this book, he climbed Mount Everest. But in the course of his life, he's a rather remarkable individual, and I'm honestly reading it because maybe he can teach me something. Maybe he can show me something that really will help as I watch and listen to him and what he says. But on the jacket it says he's a world-class athlete, acrobatic skydiver, long-distance biker, marathon runner, skier, mountaineer, ice climber, and rock climber. He was the first blind man to summit McKinley, and that story's in this book. Scaled the infamous 3,300-foot rock wall of El Capitan. Now, normal people don't climb El Capitan. Exceptional people in those skill levels climb El Capitan. Exceptional. And he's blind. And he climbs it with friends, and the friends work with him and help direct him, but he climbs. And there's times when he leaves, and he's blind. Argentina's Aconcagua. He married his longtime sweetheart at 13,000 feet on Kilimanjaro. So, that's a pretty amazing thing. Says he was born with retinoschisis, a degenerative eye disorder that would progressively unravel his retinas. And so he could see as a young child and as an early teen, but in the course of time, the retinas detached and he lost his vision. And it was a process. So he walks through the anger and the frustration and what he tried to do, but he was driven in a way to accomplish and produce and to get past all of the emotional load of that in a way that, like I said, I have to learn some of what he has to say. And I'll finish up this and I'll go find the other book that's more recent. And I've read some of the articles on the internet about him. But is his success based on his circumstances or his attitude? I'm telling you, that's a pretty easy to answer, isn't it? It's his attitude. And he had to ignore the circumstances, and he had to refuse to submit himself to those things. He got his education, he got a job, he was a teacher, he's married, he's raising a family, he's, you know, adventuring around the world in a remarkable, amazing way. Phenomenal example. What is our perspective. Is this life boring? Is being a Christian limiting? Are there things that we really would like to do in another way that now we're restrained? Well, again, it's a matter of perspective. Job 38, just going over a little bit further, and verse number 4. This is just kind of a snapshot of a moment where God did something and the angels were there, and it shows the response. But he's responding to Job, God is. He says, "Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? Tell me if you have understanding. Who determined its measurements? Surely you know. Who stretched the line on it? To what were its foundations fastened? Or who laid its cornerstone? When the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy." When you work and you produce or you create and something comes out of that that's productive and gainful, it is a rejoicing. And so it pictures this window here of this creation of God's and the angels erupting into joy at the productivity, at the creativity, at the benefit of what has then been done. As Christ said, "My Father works and I work. We're busy. We have things to do." Psalm 90 looks at God as he exists, makes a reference here in verse number 1. It says, "Lord, you have been our dwelling place in all generations. Before the mountains were brought forth, or ever you had formed the earth and the world, from everlasting to everlasting, you are God." Everlasting in that direction without end. Everlasting in that direction without end. So God just is going to always be there, and he always was. How many times could you go through your shopping list in eternity? How many times could you get all the repairs done? How many times could you do your tasks and play your sports and run your things? Well, God stays busy. That's what he says in the Bible. And he does so in a way that's productive and exciting. If in this life, in a few moments of time, by comparison, we become bored and listless and unproductive and unfruitful, then we won't be in the kingdom of God. Because God doesn't want us to lose here and then lose there. He's going to have to work with us, and we have to be responsive to him to do well here first. And then we'll fill eternity of time, at least in the one direction, when the time comes. Romans 2 and verse number 6. It says, "Who," means God, I'm breaking into the context, but I'll read it this way. "God will render to each one according to his deeds. Eternal life to those who by patient continuance in doing good." Patient continuance in doing good means you went through the tedium, you went through the sacrifice, and you continued therein. "Seek the glory, honor, and immortality." Seek immortal, eternal life in the kingdom. "To those who are self-seeking and do not obey the truth," they just want the benefit now, they want the shortcut, they just want the package, not the labor. "Those who are self-seeking and do not obey the truth, but obey unrighteousness, indignation, and wrath." I really like that. By patient continuance in doing good. It's what this life's all about. Doing good, patiently, continuously, not stopping, not drawing back, not complaining about that, not coming up short. God just says, "I'll reward everyone for your deeds, whichever ever going to be, and for some it'll go one way, for some it'll go another." Does God's promise an opportunity? Does the gifts that he give us in this life, is that kind of a slim package? Does that not fulfill our desires? Does that not give us the hope and the opportunity and the promise? Are there things that we want that are not available from God? Does the world's Do we have a form of this? Let's see what it is. Running around. Do we have a form where we have to run around a bit to taste whatever's out there to make sure that it's not something we're going to miss? And then down the road, you know, well, it's like me on adventure. Well, there's always next year. You know, is that with a relationship to God, is there always next year for that? Luke 12, verse 35. It says, let your waist be girded and your lamps burning. And you yourselves be like men who wait for their master when he will return from the wedding, that when he comes and knocks, they may open to him immediately. Blessed are those servants whom the master, when he comes, will find watching. Assuredly, I say to you, he will gird himself, have them sit down to eat, and will come and serve them. And if he should come in the second watch, or come in the third watch, patiently in continuing of doing good, and find them so, blessed are those servants. But know this, if the master of the house had known what hour the thief would come, he would have watched and not allowed his house to be broken into. Therefore, you also be ready, for the Son of Man is coming at an hour you do not expect. And Peter said to him, Lord, do you speak this parable only to us or to all people? And the Lord said, who then is that faithful and wise servant whom his master will make him ruler over his household to give them their portion of food in due season? Blessed is that servant whom his master will find so doing when he comes. Blessed is the servant that is working, that is busy, that is creating, producing, bearing fruit. Not listless, not unhappy, not frustrated, not just, you know, bored to tears, rejoicing, showing thanks, giving thanks, and being fruitful when he comes. God gives us all the potential that there could ever imaginably be, immortal, eternal life in his kingdom. And this Christian life is not a restraint or a limitation in terms of what our potential would be. It is certainly not boring. Boring is as boring does. It's our approach.